Thank you.
Hey, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. We're going to have a presentation today in Adobe Connect, so if you can get in, that'd be great. If you're not able to access it, the presentation is also available on the group wiki.
Okay, I am trying. I see the link from the email invitation. We'll see if I can get in.
This conference is now being recorded.
Okay, thank you, operator. Glenn, would you like to do the roll call honors?
Yes, certainly, Greg, I'll do that. On the call, we have Greg Aaron, George Kirikos, Barry Cobb, Martin Sutton, Roland Perry, Natros Amados, Faisal Shah, Richard Tindall, James Bladel, Michael Young, Jeremy Hitchcock. And for staff, we have Liz Gaster, Margie Milam, Marika Koenig, and Glenda Saint-Gervais.
Thank you.
Have I missed anybody? Perhaps somebody's on Adobe that I didn't catch. But I... Mike Rodenbach? I think Mike Rodenbach is on Adobe, and he's not on the call, so I'll add him to the list.
Okay, thanks. I think everyone else has joined Adobe Connect. That's great.
Yes.
Okay. Well, we have a very busy meeting today. Thank you all for coming. Of course, today we'll be hearing Margie's presentation. As most of you have met her, I'll just tell you briefly that she's the Senior Policy Counselor at ICANN. She does a lot of work for GNSO-related issues. Then, near the end of the meeting, after we have the presentation and discussion, we do need to discuss our update, which is due to the GNSO Council this week. And then we'll talk about our next two meetings, including the one that we'll have at the ICANN meeting in Sydney. Margie, are you with us?
Yes, I am. How do we want to do this? Would you like to take calls and questions during the session or just at the end when I'm done? I mean, we could do it either way, per slide or at the end.
I think we might need to be prepared to take questions during the course of the presentation because it's
it gets
into some complicated issues probably. As always, if you wouldn't mind, if there are questions, we'll see them pop up as people raise their hands in Adobe Connect, and if you like, you can take them during breaks in your presentation. How about that?
That sounds great.
Okay. And we also have, I see Andy has joined.
Yes.
And Gretchen.
Yes.
And Philip Corwin.
Yes. Hello, all.
Hello.
Okay. Well, Margie, over to you then.
Great. Well, good morning and good afternoon, everyone. Basically, this presentation covers an overview of GNSO scope and consensus policy issues. Specifically, a number of inquiries have come in to the policy staff to kind of clarify what the scope of GNSO Council policy development can be. And so this is a general description, but we'll talk specifically about how it could apply to the work that we have in this working group. So as we go forward, just ask any questions, raise your hands, and we'll see if we can answer the questions. The background, as I indicated, is to provide kind of guidance for the working groups on what GNSO policy work can cover and how it would be binding on the contracting parties. The information is in summary form, and it's not exhaustive, so you know it's very difficult to put every example out there. But what I did do is I looked at the contracts and I talked to legal counsel to try to give you an overview. But really, you need to look at the contract to get the specific limitations. This is just examples, but it's a case-by-case analysis that needs to be looked at when we go forward and decide what kind of policies we would like to recommend. There's two areas that kind of affect the scope of GNSO Council work. One is the contract, and the other is the bylaws. And so I'll talk a little bit about the bylaws, and I'll also address the contract. As many of you know, the Registrar Accreditation Agreement is a standard agreement among all registrars, so that all registrars would have the same language. But that's not the case with the registry agreements. The registry agreements vary from contract to contract, although they generally follow the same format. And so the examples that I'm going to be providing in these slides come from the .org agreement. Most of the other registry agreements have similar language, so it's a nice illustration. But I do need to caution that, you know, we would have to look specifically if we wanted to go into more detail. And legal counsel asked me to point out that this is not legal advice or a waiver of any contract rights under the agreement. So this is just kind of an overview for GNSO policymaking perspective. So when we talk about GNSO scope, the first thing we really look at is the ICANN's mission and whether what we're talking about is actually covered within ICANN's mission. So you look at the bylaws, and in one of the sections of the bylaws is this quote that I have here. The mission of ICANN is to coordinate, I think most of you know this, at an overall level, the global internet system of unique identifiers, and in particular to ensure the stable and secure operation of the internet unique identifier system. And it specifically what that means is ICANN coordinates the allocation of three identifiers, domain names, IP addresses, and then there's also protocol port and parameter numbers. Those don't really matter for our analysis, but I needed to be made sure I covered everything. And the policy development is meant to be reasonably and appropriately related to these technical functions. So that's basically the overall scope under the ICANN mission. The bylaws also give examples of how this is applied. And so when you look at the bylaws, there's a list of core values, and I didn't list them all here, but I tried to pick out ones that seem to come up over and over again. And this is something that many of you have heard over the years. So one of ICANN's core missions is to preserve and enhance the operational stability, reliability, security, and interoperability of the Internet. Other things that come into play when we're looking at GNSO Council policy is that there's also a core value that we're trying to introduce and promote competition in the domain name registrations. And where it's feasible and appropriate, we like to depend on the market to promote and sustain competition. So these are some of the core values that are listed in the bylaws. Another one that seems to apply to GNSO policy is that there's a core value that we'd like to limit ICANN's activities to those activities that require or significantly benefit from global coordination. Now, when you talk about the GNSO specifically, the GNSO is limited a little further because the GNSO is responsible for developing and recommending to the board policies related to GTLDs. And so as we talk about registration misuse policies, you know, obviously we have to keep in mind that our scope is limited to GTLDs. As many of you know, policies are enforced against contracting parties is through the contracts themselves. And so as a group, when we start talking about policies that could apply to the registration abuse, we need to think about whether we want the policies to be binding on the registries or binding on the registrars, or if we want it to be something else, maybe a guideline or a best practice. And so what I've shown on this slide is how you get policies that are binding on the contracting parties. So in the very first box on the left, the registry agreements, and again this is coming from the .org agreement, but all the others have similar language, is they actually have a list of subjects that are considered appropriate for consensus policies. And so if the policy addresses one of those topics and we go through the procedures in the bylaws to get a consensus policy adopted, then it would be enforceable against the registry. If it's not one of those lists, if it's not a consensus policy under the registry agreement, then we need to look at if we want it to be binding on the registries, is there another way to do it? And so the one thing you need to think about is you could have non-binding guidelines, and that might be appropriate, or you could actually get the registry to agree to it if it's something that is not otherwise enforceable against the registry. when we look at the registrar agreement, it's a very similar analysis. The registrar agreements also have a list of subjects that are considered appropriate for consensus policy. And if it's within those subjects and we follow the procedures and the bylaws, then it is enforceable against the registrars when it's approved by the board. But that doesn't mean that you can't have a policy that affects registrars. It just means that it may be non-binding or you may need to get registrar approval. So the contracts are helpful because they identify the subjects that can be enforceable against the registrars and registries, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's the only way to get something that would be effective. In fact, if you look at the third box, there are actually other contract provisions within the contract that are in other areas where it's not the list of consensus policies, and we'll go through this in this presentation. And so there's other areas that may be binding on registries or registrars. You just have to look to the contract to see if there's another provision that may be applicable. Then the other outcome of this work could be a recommendation to ICANN. I mean, it could be something that's not enforceable against a registry or a registrar. It could be something to ICANN, and then you don't look at the contract. You just go through the procedures and the bylaws, and if it's something that gets recommended by the GNSO Council, they could go to the board, and the board could adopt it. So the next slide, we're going to talk a little bit about the types of subjects that are identified in the registrar agreement that would be binding on the registrars if the policy was adopted in the manner specified in the bylaws. And basically, as I indicated, the registrar accreditation agreement has a list of topics. It's in Section 4.2, and that's posted on the ICANN website if you want to look at the actual language. I've tried to summarize what each of those topics cover, so this could help us identify what work we can do in this particular group. And there's a fair list, probably about 8 or 9 topics that are actually identified in the contract, and we'll go through each of them and see whether they happen to apply to the kind of work that we'd like to do in this working group. The first one is Section 4.2.1, and this is one that may be applicable to policies related to registration abuse. And this basically is if it's an issue where there's uniform or coordinated resolution would be appropriate or reasonably necessary to facilitate the interoperability, technical reliability, or operational stability of registrars, registries, the DNS, or the Internet. So in other words, if we or the GNSO as a group decided that uniform or coordinated resolution is reasonably appropriate to facilitate this, that might be a way of making the policy binding on registrars. The next section, 4.2.2, is just related to policies related to DNS registry or registry services, so that doesn't seem to apply here. The next one is Section 4.2.3, and this is the one that we've debated quite a bit on the list. And this is the one where if the policy relates to the resolution of disputes regarding the registration of domains as opposed to the use of domains, including where policies take into account use of the domains. And obviously we spent a lot of time on this section, but what I wanted to point out to the group is that this is not the only section that applies if we were to try to find a policy that related to registration abuse. We may not need to get into the details of that section if we find that a policy that we want to adopt falls into another section, such as 4.2.1, which I described earlier. The next one is principles for allocation of registered names, and that doesn't really apply to us here, but I just wanted to make sure we were inclusive. On this slide, this continues the subject. Accurate and up-to-date domain contact and name server information is listed in 4.2.4. This is the type of information. There's also 4.2.5 is a prohibition on domain name warehousing or speculation by registries or registrars. So that is something that could be a subject for consensus policy. 4.2.7, reservation of domain names. That's basically reserved names. Again, I'm not sure how that would apply in this situation. 4.2.8 has to do with procedures to avoid disruptions of registrations due to suspension or termination of a registry or registrar, so that doesn't seem to be applicable here. And then the last one is transfers of registration data, so this has to do with transfers, and so that doesn't seem to apply in this situation. So that's the list that's in the contract. Before I go to the next slide, does anyone have any questions on these two slides? Okay.
I do, Margie. This is Craig.
Okay, sure.
What is reservation of domain names exactly?
That's really the reserved list, you know, names that can't be registered because of, you know, I don't know, there's a list of .com and ICANN and all that sort of thing. So there's a placeholder that you can develop a policy related to reservation of domain names.
Country names and certain new GTLDs, for example.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Okay, so if we dig specifically into 4.2.3, and this is a section we were talking about before, this is a section that dealt with resolution of disputes. And this one, you know, basically stated that you could have a policy related to the registration of a name. I forgot the language, but we talked about it earlier. It's the a resolution of disputes related to the registration of domains as opposed to the use of domains, but it could be a policy that takes into account use of the domain. So when we dig further on that, an example, obviously, and we've already cited that before, is the UDRP, where it combines the registration, a bad faith registration, with bad faith use. But that's not the only type of dispute that could be addressed with this policy. You could have other types of registration abuse, and I've given just a couple examples here, such as false whois or, you know, a registration with stolen credit cards, just all sorts of, you know, things that relate to registration abuse. And you don't necessarily have to have the policy take into account use. It could be just a pure registration, issue that doesn't take into account use. I mean, certainly allows for use, but what we've been discussing over the list is that we wouldn't want to have a policy that's just use, because that raises issues as to whether it's outside of scope or not. Hi. Okay. So what I mentioned before is that while there's this list of what is a consensus policy within the contract, there are other areas of the registrar contract that talk about things that could be binding on registrars. And so I've cited them here. This may not be the entire list, but this gives you a flavor of the types of issues that are listed in the RAA that could be subject to policy. So obviously central whois is one of them. A registrar code of conduct is listed as 3.7.1 in the RAA. That requires a different procedure than the typical GNSO procedure, but if we thought that was something that would be appropriate to suggest, you know, we could follow the procedures in the contract, which happen to require a consensus of registrars in order to adopt it. There's also a placeholder for verification of whois. And that's 3.7.8. In 4.3.4, this one's an interesting one because it has a placeholder for specifications or policies that relate to stability that are temporary. So if there was some really big problem, and you can imagine like Conflictor, for example, if there was something that needed to get done quickly and you couldn't go through the GNSO process because it takes too much time, you could do an expedited process under this section. It requires, you know, a certain procedure, and then it would be adopted in basically on an expedited basis in order to get that in place. There's also another section, 3.8, which relates to domain name dispute resolution. And the reason why I want to highlight this one is because this one doesn't have the same limitations as the section that I cited earlier. It doesn't have the limitations on use or as opposed to use, all that language we just described. It's just, you know, if there's a policy that relates to domain name dispute resolution, it might be enforceable under 3.8. And that requires a GNSO consensus to get adopted. Then there's other ones, prohibitions on domain name warehousing and speculation, but that doesn't seem to, you know, be applicable here. And then there may be others. And the contract also has sections that apply to, it actually specifies what can't be covered under GNSO policy. And so, for example, pricing. Something that a policy that prescribes or limits the price of registrar services is in the contract prohibited. And then there's others, policies that would unreasonably restrain competition or policies that single out a registrar for disparate treatment unless justified by substantial and reasonable cause. And then there may be others. But I just wanted to point out that the contract may actually list topics that aren't appropriate for GNSO policy. When we talk about the registries, it's a very similar analysis, but as I mentioned before, the registries all have individual agreements, and they vary from registry to registry. But they all have the same kind of theme. And so the topics that we talk about here on this slide are more or less covered under most of the registry agreements. And the registry agreements are written differently than the registrar agreements because they are more clear on what can be consensus policy and what can't be consensus policy. And so they spell out the areas that are appropriate for consensus policy, and I've listed them here. And they're very similar to the ones we just discussed. So if you want a policy to apply to a registry, you need to look and make sure that it's covered under one of these topics. And so, and these are ones we've already discussed for the most part, but the first one is the one that may be applicable to us in our analysis. And if it's an issue where the uniform or coordinated resolution is reasonably necessary to facilitate the interoperability, security, or stability of the Internet or DNS, then that would be appropriate for consensus policy. So that might be an area where we might do some work. Whether if it relates to functional or performance specifications for registry services. I'm not sure that that's really applicable here, but I just want to make sure we're giving you the background so we can choose which ones are applicable. If it relates to the security or stability of the registry database, that's a topic. If it's a policy to implement consensus policies that relate to registry operations or registrars, that's also an appropriate subject for consensus policy. And again, this is the same language we've discussed earlier. They have a placeholder for resolution of disputes related to the registration of domains as opposed to use of domain names. And then what the registry agreements do is they give examples of what these things mean, and that these little diamonds at the bottom of the page are examples of implementation of these policies. So principles for allocation of registered names is one, but again, I don't see how that would be applicable here. Prohibitions on domain name warehousing or speculation. Reserve name list, and this gives you a little bit more information on what can be on a reserve name list. If it has something to do with confusion or intellectual property or technical management, you might be able to come up with a policy related to reserve names. Accurate and who is accurate, up-to-date domain name information, so that's who is, again, is an appropriate subject. Procedures to avoid disruptions due to suspension or termination of a registry or registrar. And then resolution of disputes regarding parties that may register or maintain registrations. Again, this is similar to the one we just spoke about on the registrar side, and this might be something that would be in a place where the registration of use policies might fall might apply. In other words, if we come up with a recommendation, or not we, but if in the process the GNSO decides that there should be a dispute resolution policy related to abuse, this might be an area to make it enforceable. The registry agreement also has limitations, and they're a little broader than what's applicable to the registrars. Price, obviously, is one of them. Standards for considering proposed registry services is another. Terms for renewing or terminating the registry agreement. Modifying ICANN obligations or modifying the contract limits on consensus policies or technical policies. And there may be others. This is just an example of things where, GNSO policy cannot apply. Greg, do you had a question?
Sometimes people use the term picket fence, and I hear that term occasionally. My understanding is that this is basically what the picket fence is. There are some things that are inside the fence and some things that are outside the fence.
Yeah, and that's not, it's not a defined term, so I don't even know where it originated, but it's the discussion on what is appropriate for GNSO policy and not appropriate for GNSO policy is my understanding.
Exactly, and that's mine too. Just in case the term ever pops up.
Yeah, it's not a defined term, and I'm not...
It's a colloquial term that people throw around, but this is what I think it really means. For registries or for registrars, what's in the scope as defined in the consensus policy making process, and then what is outside.
Right.
Thanks.
And then the registry contracts also have a placeholder similar to the registrars, where it's appropriate to have implement a temporary policy or specification for security stability reasons. Didn't have an expedited process, and if it gets to the process and you get 2/3 board approval, that would be binding on the registries. And then there may be others. I didn't, scan it for everything, but I just wanted to give you an overview of the kinds of things that the registry agreements cover. So when we talk about, let's talk about how this applies to the work of this group. There's lots of outcomes for policy work within the GNSO, and as a group, it's important to know what is possible, so we can decide whether our work is within scope or outside of scope. Obviously, as I described before, binding policies on contract parties. Sorry about that typo there. Non-binding policies on contracted parties, and we'll talk about how that could be applied. Best practices or code of conduct. There could also be advice to ICANN, and in that category, it could be something like recommending contract changes, and that would obviously be up to ICANN and the contracting parties as to whether that would be an appropriate change, but there's nothing that prevents a recommendation for a suggestion. And then technical specifications if it relates to policy. And so that's the end of my presentation. I don't know if there's any other questions. Well, thank you.
George has a question.
Okay.
Can you speak a little bit about the process? Like, do certain policies have to go through the GNSO, or can anybody take them directly to the board?
Sure. The bylaws require the policies to go through the GNSO. I guess you're asking if it's a GNSO originated policy. Is that what you're asking?
Let's say if it's a topic that's in regards to policymaking, the GNSO is supposed to be the policymaking body of ICANN. Does a proposed action need to go through the GNSO? Let's say, for example, the IRT as a specific example. Should that have to go through the GNSO council? Or can it go directly to the board without going through the GNSO?
The IRT work is implementation work, so it's implementation work related to something that was adopted by the GNSO with respect to new TLDs, several years ago.
Some might argue it creates a new policy, but...
But on the implementation side, that's not, that's implementation of policy versus development policy. So yeah, you can have that debate, but that's not an that type of work would go directly to the board without GNSO policy process.
Okay.
Did you have anything else, George?
No, I'm done.
Okay. Roland?
Does Roland have a question or?
Yeah, just a quick one. I didn't see anything in the sort of causes of action here which would come under the following category, which is, I'll describe as acting in the public interest to increase confidence in the internet and prevent harm to consumers. Have I missed it, or not talking about anything at all in that kind of space?
There's nothing clearly on that, but where you would argue that it could apply would be in the example here, and it's also on the registrar side, where the GNSO would make a determination that a uniform or solution is reasonably necessary to facilitate the stability of the internet or the GNSO. So if consumer protection issue has to do with stability or security, you could have it apply in that particular section.
Yeah, I don't normally think when people talk about security and stability of the internet, they mean protecting people from harmful content that's flowing around. I think they normally mean just making sure that the content gets absolutely where it's supposed to go, however harmful it might be.
I mean, my understanding is that in general ICANN has shied away from getting involved in content-related issues, as it would generally considered outside of.
And ICANN does not want to be in the position of police content to the extent that the issue, the protection issue, is purely a content issue. ICANN's mission generally is to get away from purely content. But to the extent maybe linked a registration, then, you know, that may be appropriate.
Yeah, but I would have thought that, for example, phishing was an entirely a content issue rather than any of the ones we've talked about so far today.
Also, I think it's important to note that it's not ICANN that it needs to be the policeman of content. It's the registries and registrars in particular that need to be the policeman. They're contributing to the distribution of that content.
Well, I thought part of the mission here was to be able to advise those registries on what sorts of policies they could employ so that they could better do whatever policing they're supposed to be doing. And I increasingly see registries wanting to have some role in, say, the policing of phishing by taking down domains which have been shown to be phishing domains. But, you know, a phishing domain is a site. It's a website that's very much content-related. The spam emails they send out to pull people to the phishing sites is very much a content thing. So I'm trying to work out how much we're interested in those kinds of content issues.
This is Greg. I can address this as an individual only, of course. Actually, all registries and registrars do have some ability to set their terms of service, which means the legally binding terms of service through a contract. That may say some things about the domain name and the terms under which, as long as those don't, of course, conflict with any ICANN or other contractual obligations. And most registrars, if you look at their terms of service, they'll say, please don't use the domains for illegal purposes. And they may spell out specific examples. And that's not unlike any other kind of company that you may have service with, like your credit card company has terms, or your ISP, or so on. Those are terms that they're allowed to set, or in some cases they get permission to set, but in a lot of cases it also has to do with their business practices or their positioning in the marketplace. In .info, for example, we are interested in keeping .info a place that's safe, and by that we do mean we do pay attention to phishing, for example. We're not obligated to do it, but it's something we want to do to differentiate ourselves in the market. Does ICANN have the ability to force registries or registrars to do something about phishing? That's a different question. But it's something that parties are allowed to do, so, you know, kind of do some of those things if they wish. That's my view.
Right. But Greg, it's Mike. I mean, you've got to take it to the next step. The reason why this group was formed was to look at the inconsistencies in those written policies and in how registries and registrars deal with abuse, whether they have a policy or not, and then decide whether ICANN could impose minimum standards on registries and registrars.
Yeah, I see James's hand is raised.
More just to, thanks, Greg, more just to agree with what you had said, that those are separate questions in terms of what is at the registry and registrar's discretion versus what their obligations are under under consensus policy and their contracts with ICANN. And I think that when we discuss content, we're really talking about hosting services which may or may not be associated with a registrar or registry entity, and those types of services would have their own specific accessible use policy or terms of service, as you mentioned, that are really now starting to get away from what's prescribed by ICANN.
But to the extent that, for example, in the phishing scenario where there is registration abuse, you know, like false, you know, who is information or stolen credit card information, something like that, that may be an area that could be appropriate. You know, obviously with respect to phishing, there's two types of phishing, you know, the type that's more domain name based versus non-domain name based and purely content. So, you know, so that may be something to keep in mind as well.
Absolutely, there are interdependencies with that in that particular example. But it's important to note that phishing doesn't require domain registration to you know, to be carried out. So I think that, you know, setting that line is maybe not as clear cut as it would appear on the surface.
Well, the change. I mean, trademark infringement doesn't have to involve a domain name either, but it's still illegal. And ICANN has decided a long time ago that it should regulate against it. Phishing, in my mind, is just another form of online trademark infringement. When it does use a domain name, ICANN contracting parties ought to do something about it.
And again, I agree with you, Mike. I think that the question that we're kind of touching on is ought to do something about it, and some registries and registrars, as you know, have taken a lead and are very active on, you know, addressing those issues. It's just a question of what's the role of ICANN in coordinating that or requiring that. And that's the question I think that we keep coming up to.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Greg, didn't mean to take it off.
Quite all right. Quite all right. Any other questions, comments? Roland, are you with us? If you are, you're speaking into a muted phone.
Star six.
Oh, sorry. Yes, my phone was muted. Beg your pardon. I was just trying to clarify my expectations from this process. As you've probably seen on the list, I've been trying to think through what we, you know, it is possible to achieve within this working group's auspices, I'll use that word. So really, that was quite a useful conversation just now. Thank you.
Also, Roland, you had some questions on the list, perhaps related. You had questions about There are some registries that have certain eligibility requirements. For example, one must be qualified to have a name in certain TLDs. I was wondering if we wanted to toss some questions about that to Margie since she's here. Do you want to discuss that today? I think we've lost Roland. Okay.
Sorry, Roland here again. I'm having trouble with my microphone here. So I said I was floating this idea of possibly deregistration abuse, which is somewhere that where a registrant either refuses or fails to deregister a domain when he loses his qualifications for having that domain. I mean, one example in the United Kingdom is with a special .limited.uk domain where you are only allowed to be registered if you have an incorporated company with exactly that same name. So, for example, when that company perhaps goes bankrupt or is wound up, you would have to relinquish that domain, otherwise that necessary linkage doesn't exist anymore. So what's the kind of the, you know, what's the way that you could enforce that that to happen?
And Margie, I'm wondering if there are already contractual provisions for that kind of thing. To throw out just a couple of examples, you know, to get a .museum name, one must qualify according to the rules that the registry sets. You have to be a museum under certain terms. Or if you have a .biz name, you have to use it for contractually specified terms, which is predominantly business use, or some term like that. If one does not qualify, or if it's found that one does not qualify, or if one falls out of compliance, isn't that usually addressed in the contracts, and there are recourses for dealing with those registrations?
There's also, in some cases, a separate dispute resolution procedures. Isn't there, for example, in .biz, if it's not a business, there's an eligibility dispute you can bring, you know, procedure you can follow?
I wish Jeff Newman was with us today. He could tell us.
Yeah, but that's my understanding, that it's built into the contract, and in some cases the registries actually adopt procedures for people to challenge if the particular registrant no longer qualifies.
This is Richard. I can just speak to that quickly. You don't have to be a business, but the domain has to be used for a business purpose.
Correct. Nacho, are you with us?
Yes.
Let's say that in your contract, if a .cat name has been awarded to someone, but it's not being used according to the contract, what might happen?
It has happened sometimes, not many, but it has. What we do is send a warning to the registrant, informing him that he's not in compliance with .cat rules. I must tell you that we only do this whenever we receive a complaint from someone that has taken some notice of this concrete domain name, not because we follow a strict policy of prosecuting every registrant to see whether he is in compliance or not. So whenever we receive some kind of complaint, or whenever we see that some strange pattern of registrations is being done by someone a bit suspicious of not belonging to the community, let's say a guy with a Russian name that is registering Birman.cat, pussy.cat, and all this kind of stuff, we keep an eye on these domain names to see if they are in compliance or not. So once they have registered the domain name, they have 6 months to put some content on them. And when we reach that deadline, if they are not in compliance, we warn them just once. And if they still are uncompliant 15 days later, we lock the domain. We put it on hold, so the domain name is not resolving, email is not working, and it keeps locked until the end of the term of registration.
So you have a contract that you can rely on to take care of that situation.
We have a contract with the registrants, which they must explicitly accept whenever they go through the registration process. And there is one point that explicitly says that if the registrant is not in compliance with the rules, and the rules are these and that and that other one, the domain name might be put on hold.
So in my understanding is that's pretty, that's a standard way of doing things. If a registry has eligibility criteria,
I cannot speak on behalf of others, but at least from what we know from the real sponsored registries, yes, it is standard. I don't know if everybody follows them as closely as we do, but we are quite strict on that whenever we see that there is not compliance.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions on the presentation? Hearing none. If there aren't any others, I'd suggest we talk briefly about our update to the council and our next meetings, and then kind of where we go from here now that we've gotten this this policy presentation and grounding. Marika kindly drafted an update to the council. In our charter, we were asked to give them a 90-day update. And so it's been up for a few days. And by the way, Margie, thank you very much as we close out this section. I personally found it very, very helpful.
Thank
so
you.
Anyway, we have a draft update posted. There have only been, I think, two notes posted to the list. One was to correct the spelling of James's last name. Thank you. The other one was in the section where we talked about our draft definition, it says consensus. There is a suggestion that we make clear that this is not locked in, and I'm certainly happy to amend it to say that we definitely will revisit the definition if that's helpful. Roland, did you want to make any comment?
Well, yes. I mean, my latest comment was simply that if we changed one word from may to will, that would remove the ambiguity from that particular sentence.
Okay. Any thoughts on making that change? Anyone? I'm certainly happy to do so. Any objections? So, Marika, let's change may to will. So we definitely revisit that at later meetings. And we'll change the spelling of James's name. Are there any other changes or additions that anyone would like to see to the update? Okay. So hearing none, can we assume that this document is good to release to the council?
I would make just one suggestion, Greg. It's Mike. And that is at the end where we talk about the list of known abuses, why don't we include a link to that list?
Okay.
This is Richard. I've got a comment there as well.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So I think that exact sentence that Mike has mentioned, the RAT has created a list of known abuses. I think the word known is not correct there. I think these are potential abuses. We haven't looked at them yet to determine if we think they are, if they do fall within the definition. So I think a better word than known would be potential.
Yes, I think at one point it actually read proposed.
Proposed for study, maybe. Or
something like that, yeah. So what's the language you would suggest, Richard?
Potential abuses.
Okay. Does anyone have any other language they would like to propose there? Okay, hearing none. Does anyone? Are there any objections to changing that to potential abuses? Okay, and hearing none, Marika, let's make that change in the document. Okay. Any other notes on the document? Okay. So hearing no additional changes, it sounds like we have agreement. This document will be sent to the council this week. And now we have to, having met that requirement, then we'll have to talk about our next meetings.
Thomas.
Hello? Okay. 2 weeks from today would be June 15th. And then we have a meeting scheduled in Sydney to happen on June 22nd. So let's schedule, I propose we schedule June 15th, 2 weeks from today, and continue on our biweekly schedule. And then the June 22nd meeting is scheduled for 7:30 a.m. local time. A few weeks ago we had decided that would be the best time possible because it would still allow participants to try to call in. We have requested arrangements for a conference line so everyone can join in if they're not going to be in Sydney. Can I do a poll of who will be in Sydney? If you will be, can you raise your hand? And myself, Richard, Nacho, James, Martin, Andy, Philip, Faisal, Mike, R. Actually, that's a pretty good section considering the distance we have to go. So thank you. We'll distribute call-in information before that, of course. And if you can join, this will be a regular meeting, so we'll develop an agenda beforehand. And then we did say that the meeting would be open, of course, to all members of the ICANN community, and we'll reserve some time in the meeting for Q&A if anyone from the community wants to come in and get an update on what we're doing or has any specific questions. In future meetings, my proposal is that we go ahead and start working our way through our list of proposed or potential abuses, and we can work up some process for examining what each of those means, notes on each is in or out of scope, and if it's in scope, under what sections of contracts or so forth. We'll also have to come up with a way of starting to write some material about each of these as we go through it. Eventually, our report to the council will have to delve into the details of each of these and why we're recommending anything associated with each one of them. So that'll be a topic, I guess, for our next meeting. Any thoughts on taking that course? Okay. Sounds like everybody's good with that. Okay. Good. We got through a lot today, and we are coming up at the end of the hour. I just want to throw the floor open one last time. Does anybody have any last questions or comments for today?
Andy has his hand raised. Do you have a question?
No, I just never put it down. Sorry, guys.
Well, I think Barry asked a good question on the chat about making our meetings two-hour sessions. We really did not seem to be making very good progress, at least in my opinion, so far.
Okay. Barry, you have the floor?
Per what Mike said, it seems like since we're meeting every other week, I was just curious if it would benefit us all if we tried to start meeting for 2 hours during each session to kind of start getting better traction on where we're going. And the only other comment I'd have in terms of next meetings, it seems like there was a lot of discussion relative to use of a domain versus registration of a domain, and I don't know if we have complete definition about that kind of scope or where we should head, but I'm hoping that we can kind of reel that in and have consensus about what that particular scope is.
Okay. And James, I see your hand up.
Just real quickly, can we, if it's not already done so, can we post Margie's slide deck to the wiki? If we feel that's appropriate.
Oh, it's already up there.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, so back to Barry's question is, should we move to two-hour meetings? It's a fine time to revisit that question, I think. One of the things we could do is pull the membership and see if they have that time available. That's what we did the first time around. Any objections to taking a doodle poll?
We don't necessarily have to meet for 2 hours each time. Even 90 minutes might be helpful, but having more time blocked out would be a good idea.
Okay. Let's pull the membership then, and we'll do that this week. And we'll have results for our June 15th meeting. The other question was the use versus registration issue, which is a complicated one. Barry, what aspects of that are you particularly interested in or feel that need more exploration?
Well, to be honest, I'm kind of in my rookie season for all of this, so I'm really in a more sponge mode than anything else. But what I would have to say is it sounds like there was a lot of good points on both sides of the fence as to defining the scope for registration abuse. And, you know, I guess in some ways I'd almost favor the side of the fence that encompassed just around the process up to the point that the domain is registered and excluding the areas of use, because I think it seems like a lot of the other contracts out there already kind of take care of that. But I don't know. Ultimately, it just sounded like through the discussion, through the email chats and everything, that there wasn't final resolution to that. And I just think that it's important that we nail that down in parallel with, maybe it also occurs in conjunction with when we're trying to understand what the abuse types are, that'll get fleshed out more, but it just seems like we need to nail that down.
Okay. Yeah. And as you say, some of these proposals that we have don't touch on it. We definitely will bump up against it in some of them. And may have to work our way through it again. Maybe that's the right time when we have a specific example in front of us. Okay. Any other questions? We'll keep that. We'll definitely keep that in mind, Barry. Okay. Okay. Well, we're an hour in. like we said, the presentation is up on the wiki now, and no doubt we'll want to refer to it many times in the future. So thanks again, Margie, for preparing that. It was enormously helpful. We have a few action items to take away. One of them is the proposal for two-hour meetings. And I'll follow up in the meantime with Marika to get those taken care of. So if nothing else, we can conclude for today, and we will reconvene at the same time on June 15th. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you for participating in today's conference call. You may now disconnect.